If you have a Bible, turn with me real quickly to Psalm 25. It's kind of the theme for our message this morning. And in Psalm 25, this is a psalm of David. It is a psalm that says, "To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, in you I trust. Let me not be put to shame. Let not my enemies exult over me. Indeed, none who wait for you shall be put to shame. They shall be ashamed who are wantonly treacherous." And here it's the idea that in God we trust. So today we're going to talk about in God we trust and how God can bless America. And this is a real question. I think we stand at a crossroads, don't we? Because more and more people are beginning to wonder, is God really going to continue to bless America? This week I had Ann Graham Lotz on the program with me, and she was raising the same kind of question. You know, when we look at all the things that are happening in our world, is it possible that God might remove his protection on us? The Romans 1 judgment, you know, and so again, we recognize how important that is. And so what I wanted to do today, since it's the 4th of July, is to go back and look at some of our history. And we'll go through this fairly quickly because we always want to make sure we have time to eat. Also, I'll stay around in costume afterwards. Sounds like everybody wants to get a picture today. So, okay, if you want to get a picture, should I go down to eat in this? I don't know if I should do that. Should I do that too? I don't know. Well, that would really be a stir down there. But nevertheless, I'll be glad to do so. So if you would like to have some more information about this, you can go to the website, PrestonwoodExamine.org. And by the way, if you go to a year ago at this time, there's a picture that Parker stuck in there, which I saw. It was one of those 360-degree pictures of me there. So if you want to go and get a picture of me, it's always on there at PrestonwoodExamine.org, which is at the bottom of your handout right now. Let me mention a couple of books that I thought might be helpful. I'm going to take a fair amount of the presentation today from two books. One is a book that was written a number of years ago by David Gibbs, who was with the Christian Law Association, and also by Jerry Newcomb, who has actually been kind of the host for D. James Kennedy's television program, even after Dr. Kennedy died, Jerry Newcomb. Just an excellent book. And then another book by Michael Novak, who won the Templeton Award a number of years ago. And these two are some great resources. So if you say, I'd like to read a little bit more, the first book really looks at 10 things every Christian should know about the founding of America and the framing of our government. On Two Wings is really kind of a story of the prayers, and I'm only going to go through a few, and I'm glad so because we got to start a little bit late. I may come back and do a whole session later this summer on all the various aspects of how prayer has really driven this country, and we are only going to look at a couple of those in the interest of time. By the way, we've had a number of Ask Kirby questions about prophecy, so next week I'm going to answer all the prophecy questions, okay? So, you know, and there have been all sorts of ones that some of you have submitted, so I'll try to put those in a question-answer format, and we'll do prophecy next week. But these would be some books for adults. But if you said, I'd like to teach this to my children or grandchildren, I know this might surprise you, but I think some of the best books that have come out come from, of all people, Rush Limbaugh. He's got this thing called Rush Revere. And what's so good about these books is that this story is talking about him traveling back into time, and there's a talking horse and all sorts of things. So for the young kids, there's enough in there to kind of keep their attention. But then he's put a fair amount of new material in there that gives you sort of an understanding of these different aspects. Last year when I spoke on this, there were a couple books. Now there's a new book out called Rush, Revere, and the Star-Spangled Banner. So this now kind of takes you through the pilgrims, through the American Revolution, through the founding of our country. Now, of course, Star-Spangled Banner takes you to the War of 1812. So it's a great resource if you were looking for some kind of thing that you could use, maybe some books that you could read to your children or grandchildren. And frankly, there's just a lot of material in there for the adults. But if you look in your handout, let's, if we can, just kind of give you some basic information about this. And as we go through this, some of you might say, well, I learned that in history class. I learned that in civics class. But I'll guarantee you some of the children here, unless maybe they're in a Christian school, have not learned any of this. And it's not bad for us to review some of it as well. So let's first of all talk about the Pilgrims, the founding of this country. And really we know quite a bit about the Pilgrims because indeed you have William Bradford who actually put together the essays and the record of what took place. This is another book you might think about reading on Plymouth Plantation. And it really starts from 1620 all the way to the time in which he served. The Pilgrims were originally kind of known as the forefathers, interestingly enough. They later were given that name Pilgrim, and it's based upon 1 Peter 2, verse 11. If you're not familiar with the story, the Pilgrims were actually separatist. They separated from the Church of England, and as a result, they were oftentimes persecuted, so they eventually moved to Leiden in the Netherlands, and then decided that it was time for them to maybe go and establish a colony. Some stayed in the Netherlands. Most of them decided to go to the New World. They were able to get a charter from a company in England, but they were blown off course. Some evidence to suggest that maybe they weren't even blown off course, but they were deliberately taken to a place different than where their charter was. Their charter was for the area of what that time was called Northern Virginia. Today we'd call it New York. But at that time that was called Northern Virginia, and instead they land at Cape Cod. They try to sail south. They cannot do so. So they finally are concluded that they need to establish a new charter because now they're in a place that they did not have a charter. So before they got off of the Mayflower, they actually drafted the Mayflower Compact. Many people believe that this is, in a sense, with the first constitution of the New World and provided establishment of what came later on to be some of the constitutional principles that we even have in our first declaration and then in our constitution. Paul Johnson is a British historian, and again, another great book that I might recommend to you called The History of American People, talked about the Mayflower Compact, and he put it this way. He said, what was remarkable about this particular contract was that it was not between a servant and a master, or a people and a king, but between a group of like-minded individuals and each other, with God as a witness and symbolic co-signatory. So we can see that this was the establishment of the fact that no longer were they just actually talking about a king, they were talking about their responsibility to one another with God as their witness. Now, again, we take that for granted today, but you can imagine if you've grown up in a monarchy, all of a sudden they're realizing we need to be responsible to God, and we need to be responsible one to another. Each time we go through this, I want to try to give us some principles we can apply in our 21st century world from this 17th century experience in this case. And the first is the issue of religious freedom. Why did the Pilgrims come? In large part, we read about this from William Brewster, who was the leader of the Pilgrims at that time. That time they were called the Separatists, who actually moved them from in 1606 from England to the Netherlands because of religious persecution. And then they decided to come to the New World to actually have total religious freedom. It's something to think about, isn't it? In a time when no longer do we take for granted our religious liberty. This weekend you have Justice Samuel Alito, one of the Supreme Court justices, say that the most recent decision by the Supreme Court, not even to hear a case on religious liberty, does not bode well for the future. So don't take my word for it. Take the word of an individual who was perhaps one of the most conservative justices on the Supreme Court. And he was amazed because there was a case that came about whether or not a Christian who's a pharmacist could be forced to actually give abortion-producing drugs, abortifacients. And the Supreme Court decided not even to hear the case about whether or not you have freedom of conscience. And there are more and more people that say, if you start beginning to play this out, is it possible to be a Christian baker, a Christian photographer, a Christian pharmacist, a Christian innkeeper because of some of the rules and regulations that come from the government as it relates to same-sex marriage or, in this case, on abortion? So we can learn some lessons about this issue of religious liberty, and certainly one of the action points is I think you should pray for those jurists, those lawyers and judges that are standing for religious liberty and maybe even support them. So we can learn maybe a political lesson. We can even learn an economic lesson as well. And that is that William Bradford actually was required by the group that actually funded this trip in their compact to actually have everybody work, put all the food in the common stores, and then individuals could draw from that. In other words, each person worked according to their ability, and then each person was able to receive according to their need. You ever heard that phrase before? It was a phrase used much later by a man by the name of Karl Marx. So you had, in a sense, kind of socialism. This is before Bernie Sanders, you know, but you had socialism in the 17th century. And after the first year, William Bradford realized it was not working well. Those who were able-bodied said, why are we working so hard when others are sitting around? And it doesn't seem fair, and we should have some kind of free enterprise in which we can enjoy the fruits of our labor. So what he began to do was he assigned plots of land to each one of the families, and they were still to provide some for the common stores, but they also then could benefit from the hard work. And if they worked really hard and planted a lot of crops and were very diligent about that, they received more benefit than those who were much more sluggardly or were less likely to actually work for the maximum effort. And so again, you see the beginnings, if you will, of the free enterprise system. And this was in 1621. It wasn't until 1776 that Adam Smith wrote the book called The Wealth of Nations, which really set forth capitalism. By the way, 1776 was a very good year, wasn't it? Declaration of Independence, The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith. Jeremy Bentham writes his book on utilitarianism. It's a pretty good year. We need another 1776, don't we? Well, let's move from the Pilgrims to the Puritans. And the Pilgrims and the Puritans are a little bit different. People oftentimes say, what is the difference between a Pilgrim and a Puritan? Well, it turns out that the Pilgrims were separatists, and they really wanted to separate from the Church of England. And so they were like an individual, for example, that says, you know, I want our denomination to leave this denomination because it's become too liberal. Or I want our church to leave this denomination, or I'm going to leave the church because it's become too liberal. By contrast, the Puritans actually wanted to stay within the Church of England and actually purify it. So they'd be like Southern Baptists who said a number of decades ago, you know, this direction of the Southern Baptist Convention is going the wrong direction. We're going to take it back. And actually, they were able to do so. And so the Puritans were those who settled a little bit further to the south. And what was so interesting is they established early on what were called the Puritan Covenants. You know, if you think about this, in England, there was no written constitution. The problem with that is that then those rights that British citizens have were not linked and were not written down. And so as a result, King George in particular began to abuse those, and that led ultimately to what? The American Revolution. So the Puritans decided instead to root their rights in a written document, something that they used to have in their various church covenants. And you can go and look at some of the things that they wrote down. But in 1641, they actually produced what were called the Body of Liberties. And these were 98 separate protections which are given to the Puritans. And recognize that this was written down in 1641, long before you have the United States Constitution in 1788 and 89. So look at 150 years earlier, you see things like due process of law, equal protection, a trial by a jury of your peers. And I love this one. There were even prohibitions against cruel and unusual punishment. You ever heard that phrase? That's the Eighth Amendment of the Constitution. And yet these were written down 150 years before the U.S. Constitution, which again shows you that it was Christian founders of this country in large part that gave the impetus for what later became the U.S. Constitution. So we have the Puritans, we have the Pilgrims. Let's talk about one more. We'll move now to Virginia, and that would be Jamestown. This colony did not flourish eventually, but it did initially. And again, I think we can learn some great lessons even from Jamestown, because here you have Thomas Dale, the new governor of Jamestown, who recognized the same problem. There was no relationship between work and reward. And so he also instituted what today we would call free enterprise or private property, free market kinds of principles. And so he required that each man would actually get 3 acres of land, and he only had to work no more than 1 month for the common stores, which ended up being, if you think about it, kind of a tax rate of 8%. Would you like to go back and live in Jamestown? That if you think taxes were high now, just imagine 8%, essentially, you know, 1 month out of 12, you worked for, if you will, the government, worked for the common good. The other 11 months you work here. There is what is known as a cost of government statistic that's been put together, and it looks at the amount of federal tax, state tax, local tax, and regulations necessary, and they've concluded that the cost of government date, we are just about ready to hit it in about another week. Essentially, you work for the government for more than 6 months, and then you try to feed yourself for the remaining 5+ months. And I think you can see that we've gotten a little past the 8%, haven't we? Let's move on to a couple other issues, because you cannot really understand some of the things that happened in America without the First Great Awakening. We had a First Great Awakening before the American Revolution. We had a Second Great Awakening that took place before the American Civil War. And after we go through this today, I think many of you are going to be praying for diligently, as we heard today, Stephen Smith talking about a Third Great Awakening. We really certainly need that. But let's talk about what that was. And it really began in two places simultaneously. In the New England area, it was actually begun in the church with Jonathan Edwards. Now, most of us know Jonathan Edwards for a very famous sermon. What was that? Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, right? And, of course, that is a very famous sermon, but he was really one of the brightest people that existed in the 18th century and went to Yale University. And I had a chance to, a number of years ago when we were in Connecticut, preach in the pulpit where he preached when he was a student. By the way, that church has been there since the early part of the 1700s, but the church I'm in was actually the third church. The other two got burned down by the Indians. That's how long that church has been there. And when you climb up on those rickety stairs, you wonder if one of them is going to collapse underneath you. But nevertheless, it was fun to see what it was like for Jonathan Edwards to preach in a church, which is only about twice the size of this sanctuary here. But anyway, while he was preaching, he felt like all of a sudden a flash of lightning came through the congregation and revival broke out all over New England. Well, simultaneously, George Whitefield in the southern part of our colonies, a man who was actually born in England, actually began to preach all up and down the eastern seaboard. And up until that time, there had never really been a call forward. Today, as we always did, we have someone encourage them if they're going to come forward and give their lives to the Lord, or if they want to join the church, we have them come forward. That was instituted by George Whitefield. Matter of fact, he also would have prayers. He would have music. Frankly, if you were to go to a George Whitefield crusade, it would look just like a Billy Graham crusade. Most of the ideas that we take for granted today came from George Whitefield. He was also a very famous actor, interestingly enough, so he used all sorts of flair and dynamics and things of that nature, but he began to preach all up and down the eastern seaboard, and many people believe that that is another thing that led to the American Revolution. Paul Johnson, who I quoted from just a minute ago, pointed out that the Great Awakening may have touched as many as 3 out of 4 Americans, interestingly enough. You know, when we talk about revivals today, we have never seen anything like it. Can you imagine where 3 out of every 4 people in America are going to church, they're going to worship services, they are humbling themselves and praying? You can see what a phenomenal situation this was. It was unprecedented as a spiritual activity. And also points out that this may have actually sounded the death knell to British colonialism, because up until that time, the colonies really saw themselves individually. The Georgia colony related back to King George, and the colony, for example, in Massachusetts related back to George. But now, all of a sudden, they began to see themselves as 13 colonies as Americans for the first time. And so the religious revival, in many cases, actually put the end to colonialism and the beginnings of the American Revolution. Well, while I'm talking about the clergy, let's get into that in a little bit more detail, because one of the things that was so interesting is the clergy at that time were actually speaking and preaching about all sorts of very important issues that led to the American Revolution. And so we can see that that was certainly the case. And back in 1812, it's interesting that John Adams, or 1818, actually wrote down why we have the American Revolution. And it's kind of intriguing because he actually identified the people he thought that were most responsible for the American Revolution. Now, if you were to go to SMU and maybe talk to a history professor and ask a history professor, why did we have the American Revolution? Probably you'd hear, you know, taxation without representation. I'm going to give you an assignment. This weekend, I want you to take a moment to read the Declaration of Independence. And as you read that, you'll realize there were actually 24 different reasons why the American Revolution took place. And one of the least significant was the idea of taxation without representation. That only came later when Marxist professors said, well, there had to be economic reasons, and that's the only economic reason they could find. There were all sorts of abuses of power that are listed in there. But nevertheless, if you were to ask who was most responsible for the American Revolution, I think our history professor would probably say, well, obviously George Washington, maybe Benjamin Franklin, certainly Samuel Adams. Well, that's kind of intriguing because John Adams actually said that the revolution was effected before the war commenced. The revolution was in the mind and hearts of the people, and a change in their religious sentiments, their belief about God, changed their view. And so he actually spent some time in this particular essay called The Meaning of the American Revolution in 1818 and actually listed those men which he thought were most responsible for the American Revolution. And the names he mentioned were Dr. Mayhew and Dr. Cooper. And you've got to be going, who are these people? Well, it turns out they were pastors. Matter of fact, there was an attitude that was held by the British regulars, and they used to refer to the clergy as the Black Regiment. By that, because they wore black robes. He said, really, in a sense, we're fighting these people on the battlefield because of what these people are saying in the pulpits. But again, you got to say, who is Dr. Mayhew and Dr. Cooper? Well, it turns out that Jonathan Mayhew was the minister of West Church in Boston, which is one of the places where the American Revolution broke out. He actually died before the American Revolution, but he preached a very famous sermon before the American Revolution on civil disobedience. There would be lots of colonists that wondered, would it be right to ever actually rebel against the British crown? Because after all, we're British citizens, even if we are here in America. And so he began in his sermon to preach through civil disobedience. Were there ever times when people would disobey government? Yes, the Hebrew midwives, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Even in the New Testament, you have when the New Testament disciples are told not to preach the gospel. What do they say in Acts 5:25? We will obey God rather than men. Well, that was such a powerful sermon that then they reprinted that sermon, and copies of that reprinted sermon were scattered all over the colonies. And for the first time, many of these Bible-believing colonists, later patriots, began to think, well, there might be a time in which if the British crown is so disobedient and so unbiblical and is calling for us to do unrighteous things, we might actually consider to actually go against the crown. So the first thoughts about that came, interestingly enough, from a sermon that was delivered in Boston. Dr. Samuel Cooper was a minister of Brattle Street Church in Boston. Interestingly enough, members of his congregation fought in a battle of Bunker Hill. Ever heard of that? Actually, it's Breed's Hill, but that was the name it was given there. If you've ever gone to the Freedom Trail in Boston, you get to see where that takes place. You get to see that. You can recognize in his congregation was Samuel Adams and John Hancock. And have you heard any of these names? And you begin to see how, again, the preaching from the pulpit was affecting the American Revolution. Just out of interest, I always love to tell the story of John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg because that gives us at least one story out of Virginia. And the story is fairly well known. It is an individual, interesting enough, John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg, who actually, interestingly enough, was a Lutheran pastor, but he also served in the House of Burgesses in Williamsburg. If you've ever been to Williamsburg, you can actually go and sit right where he sat. And the story is told that as he is there in the House of Burgesses, the story comes back that actually there has been a fire, there has been a battle between the militia, the regulars, and the British in Boston. Now it's obvious we're headed towards war, Lexington and Concord and all the rest. And so he realizes now that it is time to join the military. So he rides from where he is in Williamsburg, which is sort of in the southeastern corner of Virginia, all the way up to Woodstock, Virginia, which is in the northwest corner of Virginia, arrives Saturday night. Sunday morning, he's in the pulpit. They have not heard anything. There's no CNN. There's no Fox News. There's no internet. And so he now begins in his sermon to describe what has happened and preaches on Ecclesiastes 3. And he says there's a time for peace, and now there is a time for what? War. Then this is, of course, a painting of him. What he did is steps out of the pulpit and takes off his vestry garments, and underneath he is wearing the uniform of an officer in the Continental Army, and says, I have decided now to join the army. He goes to the back of the church and calls for the men in the church to join him, and 300 men in that church join him. And he now serves under George Washington all the way from 1776, Battle of Trenton, all the way to Yorktown. Eventually becomes a major general in the Continental Army. But this is a fun story as well, because his brother, and that is Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg, is a Lutheran pastor in Manhattan Island, and he's writing to his brother saying, you have lost your mind. What are you doing? You're a pastor. It's bad enough that you serve in the Congress and the Burgesses. Now you're in the military. And, of course, you have Peter Gabriel writing back to him saying, well, I'm serving so that you can have freedom in your pulpit. Well, that doesn't last long, because there's a major battle in Manhattan. Matter of fact, George Washington is almost taken and killed, and they push Gabriel Muhlenberg out of his particular, Frederick Gabriel Muhlenberg out of his pulpit, and eventually, after the Revolutionary War is over, both of them end up serving in Congress. If you go to Congress today, they have the Hall of Statuary, and you see the pictures, interesting enough, of John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg and Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg, but that's not all the story, because if you ever go to the archives, you will see the Declaration of Independence, you'll see the Constitution, and you'll see the Bill of Rights. And if you look at the Bill of Rights, it's signed by two people, John Adams and Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg. John Adams signs it because he is the vice president. Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg signs it because he is the first Speaker of the House. The man who at once said there surely should be no reason that people should be involved in politics ends up being the first Speaker of the House, of the House of Representatives. Let's talk real briefly about education, and we can see again the influence of Christianity. It turns out that when you were to educate individuals, oftentimes there was definitely a religious component, and we can see that to be the case. The first of those is we see in the New England Primer. Here, just teaching something as simple as the ABCs. A, in Adam's fall, we sinned all. B, heaven defined the Bible mind. C, Christ crucified for sinners died. Even as they were teaching the ABCs, they were teaching biblical ideas. Also, the first schools were established in large part to guarantee that everybody was literate. If you've ever been on the Freedom Trail, there's a place where they stop and they tell you this is where the first school was built in Boston. And it was built based on what is called the Old Deluder Act. That is, they wanted to keep Satan, the old deluder, from actually taking people into heresy. They wanted everybody to know how to read the Bible for themselves. Interesting enough, John Quincy Adams used to jokingly say the chances of finding a person who was illiterate in Boston was less likely than seeing a multiple number of shooting stars at night. In other words, it was very, very rare, because everybody knew how to read, and they wanted them all to know how to read God's Word for themselves. You go to Harvard College, it was established to train men in the ministry, and if you look at the law and the statutes, it's to let every student be plainly instructed and earnestly pressed to consider well the main end of his life and studies is to know God and Jesus Christ, which is eternal life. You go to Yale University, and here, these are the regulations. I've got a copy of it, and the first page is kind of just some introductory material. But then these are the regulations. This is what was required of every student that went to Yale College back in 1745. It says, all scholars shall live religious, godly, and blameless lives according to the rules of God's word, diligently reading the Holy Scriptures, the fountain of light and truth. That was the first requirement. The second was constantly attend upon all duties of religion, both in public and secret. That'd be a good creed today, even for Prestonwood Christian Academy, wouldn't it? I mean, look at that. I mean, that is what was required of somebody to attend school at Yale College. I didn't mention prayer. Prayer was so essential in the founding of this country and the framing of this government. You can see this in a number of ways. First of all, when you had 5 months after the Declaration, you had George Washington, who was our commander at that time of the military, was losing battle after battle after battle. They had a slight victory in Boston, but they lost horribly in New York. And by the end of 1776, it looked like this was going to be the end of this uprising. And yet they called for a time of prayer and fasting and repentance on December 11th. And most of you may know the story of what happened on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. And those were the battles of Trenton and Princeton. The few victories that George Washington could point to and what sustained them through the rest of the American Revolution. First prayer, you can go back a few years before when they had the first Continental Congress in 1774. You had a real problem because they wanted to open it in prayer, but they weren't sure how to do this because you had Congregationalists, you had Puritans, you had Quakers, you had Anabaptists, you had a few Baptists, you had a few Catholics. Who were we going to pick? And interesting enough, they settled on Reverend Duchesne, and this is a painting of the first prayer meeting where all of them are on their knees opening their first time of Congress in prayer. We also see that there was a time of thanksgiving that George Washington, then the commander-in-chief, later our first president, called for at the end of the third year to call, and this is one of the declarations in which General Washington, this is a presidential proclamation, but we have others in which you have General George Washington calling for a time of thanksgiving during the American Revolution. And time again, you see how important prayer was. Well, in the few minutes remaining, let's talk about moving now from the founding of this country to the framing of this country. And this is going to be, I think, very significant as well. And the first of those, of course, would be the Declaration of Independence. Some people ask when they talk about the Declaration of Independence, what is the distinction? And the first distinction is that the Declaration really sort of tells you the why of American government. Why did we break from England? The Constitution really tells us the how of American government. And if you want to read a really good book on the subject, this is one that I got when I was in Vermont last year. It turns out it's written by Joseph Ellis, and he actually was going to be in the bookstore right there in Manchester, Vermont, to actually do a book signing. And it's called The Quartet. And it's his argument that really we have two American revolutions. We have the first American Revolution with the Declaration, and I'll talk more about this in just a minute. But then we had a second American Revolution because we had the Articles of Confederation, and those weren't working. And so he identifies George Washington, Alexander Hamilton. By the way, we're hearing a lot about him lately because of that Broadway play. And also Alexander Hamilton here, James Madison and John Jay. And I'll talk more about that in just a minute. But you are seeing many people recognizing that you actually had a second American Revolution to actually bring about the government we take for granted today. Well, let's focus for a minute on the Declaration. Because the Declaration of Independence, I think, once again, even though it's primarily a secular document, shows the Christian influence even in the founding of our country. If you read the Declaration, and again, I would suggest that you would do so. Why not? It's 4th of July. Could you just take a minute to read the Declaration? You don't even have to go find one. You can look online. But when you go there, you'll see something very interesting. It mentions God either explicitly or implicitly four different times. First of all, it talks about the laws of nature and nature's God. I'm going to talk more about that in just a minute, but that was a direct quote from John Locke, and that was certainly talking about God directly. But then it also goes on to say that we are endowed by our Creator by certain what? Unalienable rights. That among these are what? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Number three, it also said that they were recognizing that they were exercising civil disobedience, essentially treason. So they were appealing to the supreme judge of the world to make sure that their attitude was correct. And finally, number four, they recognized that they were now about ready to go against the greatest military power of the 18th century with a number of regulars and a ragtag bunch of militia. And for them to think that they would win was all based upon this idea of protection of divine providence. God's mentioned either explicitly or implicitly four times. Fortunately, we still post the Declaration of Independence, but, you know, now that we're stripping down the Ten Commandments, I wonder how long that one's going to stay up, but nevertheless, you can see it. I mentioned this idea of God, of laws of nature, nature's God. This is a quote, actually, from John Locke. And Thomas Jefferson said that almost all the ideas he had came from other sources. And if you've ever read John Locke's two treatises of government, he explains that the law of nature is kind of this idea of what we see generally around us. It's kind of the general revelation. And the law of God is, of course, God's eternal law, which is written in our hearts. And again, if you want to understand how religious this is, if you read through the two treatises of government, there are hundreds of Bible references in that particular book. When you're writing in the 17th and 18th century, to try to make your case, you always went back to the scriptures to make your case. A little different than what we see today. Another source which Thomas Jefferson acknowledges comes from George Mason. And if you've ever been to Williamsburg, you get to go through George Mason's home. Now, for some of us, George Mason's best known for the man that pushed forward the Second Amendment, which, as far as I understand, we still have, but I think there are some that want to get rid of that one, too. But anyway, George Mason's not only known for the Second Amendment, he's known for something else. He was the drafter of what was called the Virginia Declaration of Rights. Tell me, as I read one quote from the general regulations there and the Declaration of Rights, if this doesn't sound a little bit like the Declaration of Independence. Because it says in the Virginia Declaration of Rights that all men are by nature equally free and independent and have certain inherent rights, namely the enjoyment of life and liberty and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. Does that sound familiar? Of course. Those are the ideas that come from George Mason, as well as others that were part of that Virginia Declaration of Rights. Again, quoting from Paul Johnson, he says, "There's no question the Declaration of Independence was, to those who signed it, a religious as well as secular act, and that the Revolutionary War had the approbation of divine providence." Finally, let's talk about the Constitution real quickly. And in the Constitution, let me mention some of the books I just mentioned. One, The Quartet, which is really a reminder of indeed the fact that even though we had now been freed from England, we had these Articles of Confederation, but they weren't working. And if they hadn't done something else, eventually those states might have ended up countries. And the North American continent might have looked a lot like Europe. You know, eventually we'd just have different countries. But they unified them finally under one particular federal government. And those were very important. And three of those individuals, James Madison, John Jay, and Alexander Hamilton, were the writers of what are called the Federalist Papers. We'll get to that in just a minute. But another book I might recommend, this is came from the Heritage Foundation by Matthew Spaulding and Ed Meese. This is an excellent book because it's called The Guide to the Constitution. It actually explains every one of the clauses in the Constitution. I'm thinking of buying four of those and sending them to Supreme Court justices. Now, maybe I need five and pass them to, you know, this is very, very well done and provides a historical background for every single one of the clauses in the United States Constitution. But one of the challenges that many professors had up until fairly recently, this was research that was done by my major professor at Georgetown University, as well as a professor at the University of Houston and a major professor at LSU, was where did these ideas come from? Because the United States Constitution almost seems to have sprung out of nowhere. Because you didn't have constitutions like this before. We'd never had a republic like this. So where did these ideas come from? So the various researchers went back and looked at all the writings during the founding period. And they came up with about 15,000 different writings. And they found about 3,000 different citations. And so they went back and said, where were the most cited things? Well, there were sightings from John Locke and Montesquieu and a few others, but the one source quoted most often was what? You can see it on the screen, the Bible. One third of all the quotes written from the founders to each other as the Constitution was being drafted were quotes from the Bible. But then if you go back and look at those quotes, three-fourths of those quotes actually came from the sermons of that day. It's one of the books on my shelf, The Political Sermons of the American Founding Era. And so what it was is that when they were drafting the Constitution, they were quoting back and forth from the writings and basically the sermons given on that day. Remember, just a minute ago, I mentioned that when an individual would deliver a sermon, there were no DVDs, there's no cassette tapes or anything like that, so the sermons would be written out. Matter of fact, when I gave that sermon in Connecticut, they asked me to do the same thing they'd been doing for more than 200 years, to write out my sermon, put it in a, not that anybody would want it, but nevertheless, you know, in a pamphlet, and it was available. Well, these pamphlets were making their way out here. So as the individuals were drafting the Constitution, they were quoting from the sermons of that day. Is that amazing? We're talking about having another constitutional convention, an Article 5 Constitution, where we'd actually provide another amendment to the Constitution. It's kind of interesting, you know, some people have been talking about that, including the governor of the state of Texas and Mark Levin and others. And so we might have another constitutional convention that might happen someday. Do you think they'd be quoting from the sermons of pastors in the 21st century? Probably not, but they were in that day. One other very important figure that I might want to mention is John Witherspoon. He was the president of what at that time was called the College of New Jersey. It ultimately became Princeton. He taught James Madison, 77 members of Congress, 3 Supreme Court justices, and he signed the Declaration of Independence. Yes, pastors signed the Declaration of Independence. Isn't that amazing? But he was also instrumental in that even before the Declaration, there were some that still wondered, is it right for us to separate from England? And he preached a very famous sermon that was in pamphlets that were passed around, and it was preached on the dominion of providence over the affairs of men. Up until that time, he wasn't sure we should separate from England, decided we should, and his sermon was one that convinced a number of others to sign the Declaration of Independence. John Eidsmo, in his book, Christianity and the Constitution, puts it this way. He said, one thing is certain, the Christian religion, particular Reverend Witherspoon's Calvinism, which emphasized the fallen nature of man, influenced Madison's view of law and government. Why do we have checks and balances? Because they believed in human sinfulness. The best way to understand that is to recognize that as the Constitution was drafted, it now needed to be ratified by the various states. There was a real question as to whether or not the state of New York would ratify the Constitution. So they wrote a series of newspaper columns. Who are they? Well, these people. James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay wrote what eventually became some of the most famous newspaper columns in American history. They were eventually put together in what are called the Federalist Papers and give the justification for all the different aspects of the Constitution. You might say, well, this is kind of interesting. Who's James Madison? Well, James Madison was known as the architect of the Constitution. He was married to Dolly Madison. He later became a president. Alexander Hamilton, I think more and more people learning about him. You can find him on your $10 bill. And, of course, there's a play right now in New York about Alexander Hamilton. He actually served under George Washington all through the American Revolution, served as our first Secretary of the Treasury. And some people think that he might have become a president if he had not been killed in a duel by Aaron Burr. There was some debate at the time because since Alexander Hamilton was not born in the United States, he was born in the Caribbean, some wondered whether or not he would be a natural-born citizen. Back in that day, there was a lot bigger issue about that than apparently today, but nevertheless, this was the case. And, of course, then you might say, well, who's John Jay? John Jay, interesting enough, when he wrote the Federalist Papers, was the vice president of the American Bible Society. Later, he became the president of the American Bible Society and became the first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Isn't that amazing? Just think about that today. We do have a vacancy on the court right now. Just imagine that the next president decides that he will pick, actually a good friend of mine, who's the current president of the American Bible Society. Do you think that's happening? Not likely, but isn't it interesting that the first Chief Justice of the United States was the president of the American Bible Society? John Jay was known as the founder of the Sunday school movement in America, and he was our first Chief Justice. We've come a great way, haven't we? A little further distance. Let's look at the Constitution real quickly. This is a picture of the signing of the Constitution. You can see George Washington, very important because he was the chairman of this. Of course, you can see John Jay and Alexander Hamilton and Benjamin Franklin and all sorts of other individuals that are standing around that. Emmy Bradford, who was at University of Dallas a number of years ago before he died, wrote a great book called A Worthy Company. And he concluded that 50 of the 55 men who signed the Constitution were church members who endorsed the Constitution. Now, frankly, if you go to a lot of history classes, they'll make you think that everybody that signed the Declaration and everybody that drafted the Constitution were deists or secularists. You know, these are individuals that sometimes would have prayer meetings would last 3 hours, which is quite a feat for secularists and deists, don't you think? You know, but, you know, it certainly, I think, illustrates again how influential Christianity was. Well, I'll conclude with one question I always like to leave anybody when we talk about that, and that is, I think really if we look at this, we'd have to say that any fair-minded person looking at our history would have to agree that Christianity was important in the founding of this country, and Christianity was important in the framing of this government. I think any fair-minded person would have to agree with that. Yeah, there are people trying to revise history and all the rest, but looking at this, you'd have to conclude that that is the case. So indeed, if Christianity was so important in the founding of this republic, why do so many people today think that it is irrelevant to the maintenance of it? I think the answer is that's why we have to say that God has blessed America. And more importantly, we need to make sure that we bless America. And we need to stand for religious liberty. We need to stand for our rights and recognize that we are at a crucial time where we need to take our Christian convictions into the public arena and speak truth into a culture that desperately needs it. Parker?